8.7, let's see.
So how about without looking at the solution? Could you? The problem might be easier than the solution.
I'm not so sure if the way they solved it, I couldn't think of anything simpler than that. Mm-hmm. I mean, a few parts trimmed down on, but in the end, to show that the instability grows, this does seem to be the easiest way to do it.
Okay, so I guess the first part is straightforward, just looking at through the question and looking at the instability answers. So did anybody manage to do it? So you did some? Did you do that?
Well, I followed through the way they did it in the mm-hmm. book pretty much.
Mm-hmm. So you said you didn't understand. Mina, you had problem with problem two, you couldn't do a problem two.
Especially the second and last part. The first part, it's almost a straightforward part. Mm-hmm. The second and third part, I couldn't just do. Mm-hmm. Why Kelvin Helmholtz, inestabilities, they form like that.
Mm-hmm.
He introduces Eddie.
Eddie.
Which I didn't know about.
Uh-huh. Eddie just is vortices, rotation. Cells, I guess you could say. That's what they call it. So it's nothing that big of a deal. So, okay, but you did part A. So why didn't you do part A first, Mina? Okay. How about you, Nathan? Did you do part A? Or? No. No, no, no. Okay. Well, let's start with part A.
It's the same as part
A. Let's just discuss it. So. So they say you don't learn something until you teach it, so why don't you like this? So that's why you're supposed to teach it.
You have to know what you're teaching.
Well, exactly. You learn it as a teacher.
I can't just teach like modern history. No.
But you learn modern history as you teach it. You make modern history.
Modern failings in teaching.
Modern history, good. That's all.
This thing is really steep. You need that difficulty to put it in my pocket.
Yeah, you don't have to put it in your pocket. Okay. Sorry, you have to erase something. Okay, so let's see what we have to do. It's problem 3.7. So turbulence is very important in astrophysics. So, and it also turns out very hand waving almost everywhere that it appears, but there aren't really that many exact factors you can do. Or anything like that goes. So, but this problem gives you an idea of how some of the exact things come about.
Yeah, so do you want to see how instabilities, I guess, form in the, in the shear between two medium or something like that? So, if they assume that if you have a medium that the flow is flowing, they divide it to two regions. Which one of the region has a, they assume that has a velocity zero and the other one has a velocity. And then, and they assume that velocity is in the x direction and turbulence forms in the z direction or something like that. Or, a gradient of pressure and velocity, they form in the z direction or something like that. So. Then they assume that this small perturbation is going to form in the z direction, which can be a periodic function of exponential of ikx minus omega t. So they assume it to be periodic, which I wasn't sure why they assume it like that.
Well, basically, the way I figure you can do this is that the equations we're working with, I believe, are linear, so you can decompose it into a sum of solutions. And now, if you take any small perturbation at all, you can do a Fourier transform into a sum or integral periodic function. So you just need to solve for one of those, and you could, in theory, detransform it.
Okay.
So this is of course very general. I'm guessing you must have seen this at other places. Like for example, when you solve a Weigel equation in a mechanism, you assume it's a sum of plane waves, and basically anywhere in physics that you have a homogeneous equation in the sense that there is no explicit dependence on x in your equation, or explicit dependence on time in your equation, then you can assume a Fourier decomposition. And the different Fourier components don't couple to each other. Because basically all you have are time derivatives or spatial derivatives. And the time and spatial derivative of this function is proportional to that function itself. So if you have a superposition of these functions, then acting with derivatives on them gives you the same function with some factors that depend on k and omega. So you can basically, since this forms a complete set, essentially, you can solve this independently for every coefficient. Solve the question independently for every coefficient of the Fourier coefficients, I mean. And they don't couple to each other. That's the idea. But okay, okay. That's pretty general in
okay. Then, if you write down the Euler's equation without viscosity. So it means they're assuming it without any turbulence has started. So let's see that. A prime symbol indicates the instability, like this, like delta V, stuff like that.
So V is some V zero plus delta V plus V prime, is that?
I guess so.
Okay.
I guess they mean something like that. And if you ask him that the velocity, original velocity, is just in the x direction, then V prime is equal to the x, just obvious. And then if you take the divergence of both sides of this equation, because we assume that our fluid is incompressible, then divergence of V prime is zero, and then that it's going to indicate that Laplacian of pressure is going to be zero, or pressure is constant.
So where did that come from?
Well, if we take the divergence of both sides, then divergence of this is going to be zero, and also this, and then Laplacian is going to be zero.
So this is a bit curious because you would think there are two terms in so there should be a term that looks like V prime dot grad V. Wouldn't be a term like that?
V prime dot grad V.
Well, yeah, but we've taken this and decomposed it into the V and V prime equations. So we've got, you know, one equation for the V part, one for the V prime, and here for the V prime parts, we just take the larger term, which is V dot grad of V prime.
So could you actually write down what you think this equation is not V prime?
Well, I guess they start from Euler's equation. V over rho. Then let's substitute for V as V prime plus, or V plus delta V or something like that, which delta V can be V prime. And then they substitute it in there and something like that.
So I guess V, or the call V naught or V bar or something, that is constant.
Yeah, exactly.
So the gradient of that doesn't enter.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay.
Except at the boundary, something funny might happen. So we'll see.
Okay.
Why is the gradient of the time derivative for you?
And divergence of V prime is zero. That's the only.
Oh, okay.
Because it's a compact.
Okay, then we can assume the pressure also as a periodic function of a function fz and then. Which I guess makes sense because we assume that we got the Laplacian of p prime is zero, so we can, you know, we can have this solution which applies in there, so.
Does this have zero Laplacian? No.
Well, for some fz, it will.
It depends on fz. Yeah.
Yes, okay.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay, okay.
So we have to assume what is, you know, what kind of fz we have to put in there so that the Laplacian is going to be zero. So this leads us to this equation, as they say. So for the region that is under consideration, which is, we assume it's in the positive side of the z direction, we have to choose f b proportional to exponential of minus kz, so that the, you know, the wave is going to damp out. So that makes sense. So in this case, we have if you substitute it back into Euler's equation, which I just copied, I didn't do it actually. So. You get the velocity in that direction, which is in this form.
This you got from the Euler's equation.
Yes.
Yes, good.
And did they talk about the displacement of the surface in the z direction? Mm-hmm. And the whole displacement is just d over dt is the same as v prime z. So so that's the Eulerian to Lagrangian definition or something like that.
Let's see. So partial t is equal to. So what is that? That's v.
That's v prime z.
So that v appears, that's a constant. The next v that appears, that's a constant.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. That's the Eulerian to Lagrangian definition.
Yes.
So d by dt is partial of partial 2 plus v top dot partial of partial. Good.
So we can assume again L is in the same form because of that. Minus 1 over t. So we substitute it back in the equation above because then we promise that is x minus omega t. And 2.1 is minus 3 t1 over k. 3 minus omega. And that's the pressure. The disturbed pressure or whatever.
And so let me understand. So P1 was the coefficient. What is P1?
Oh, P1?
Yes.
It's the, I guess, the original pressure.
The original pressure. That doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. We don't have original pressure. That's constant, so that doesn't matter.
Oh, that's rho 1, sorry. That's rho.
Rho 1?
Yes.
Okay. That's so rho 1, that's the
depth. There is a rho, but there's no P at the first instance.
So let's understand what is that equation? Where does that come from? So V prime Z is exponential of high L. Or it's a, right? Actually no, what you're saying, I think that V prime Z is pi L. What is L?
L is just the direction of the disturbance from the Z.
Okay. So how do you get that? V prime of Z is pi L K X Y X.
I guess they just substitute for L in this equation.
Uh-huh.
And then they get the V prime Z as in this form.
Shouldn't there be a V somewhere?
A V somewhere. Hmm. Yeah, there is. Oh, yeah. That's. Okay, that's wrong. That should be the form.
That makes it much better.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Perfect. And P prime 1, that's you subtracting from that relation.
Yeah.
On the other.
Yeah. And then for the other region, side 2, in the V0 side, if you choose the solution with positive value of Kz, then we get P prime 2. And then we can discuss if rho 1 is equal to rho 2, or if they're not equal, what happens?
Let's keep them general.
Okay.
See what happens.
Okay. So in general case, if P.1 is equal to P.2, then we get a dispersion relationship. Yes. Oh my God, it's KV. So that has an imaginary part.
Mm-hmm.
So it means that the perturbation is going to damp out as we go to farther distances. But I don't know how it's going to explain, you know, the shape of Kelvin Helmholtz in a stability like that.
Why it looks like.
Yeah.
Okay, so we can. Is that one of the things that you asked?
Yeah, that's part B.
And that's part B. Yes. Okay. So we can write it out, but. Let's see first if you understand it. So you just equate those two expressions for P prime 1 and P prime 2, and solve for omega, and that's what we get. There is the real part for omega, which I mean just as oscillatory, so it doesn't mean anything. Is that kind of funny? I would think that part is also crossing minus. Are you sure that's the expression?
That's the expression that they have in the book, otherwise if it's wrong.
Okay, so I think just look at this. Because it, I would think you wouldn't prepare a sign of the frequency. The frequency should have two signs, not one. If the real part of the frequency.
Mm-hmm.
3.7. Because, I mean, the reason is that to get a real solution, you have to combine positive and negative frequencies.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe they just took it that was implied.
Mm-hmm. I guess. Yeah, sorry. Okay, so there is something. There is something I prefer to sign. There is something. Okay. Good. Now, so it says that always you have an instability. Always you have an instability. It's actually interesting. So what are the ways that you think you can avoid this instability in nature? Because it says that as long as there are two flows next to each other.
Velocity is the same, then there won't be any shear.
If velocity is the same, that's of course. If V is... No, actually, no, that's... Velocity doesn't enter there, is it?
Well, there is a V, but...
No, V's on the real part,
yeah.
I guess if one of the densities is much lower than the other.
I think that's not the way it is, actually. So this KV is multiplied by everything there. So KV is not in the numerator of that. KV is multiplying everything. I mean, just dimensionally, if you think about it. Right? Good, that's more correct dimension, right?
Mm-hmm.
Perfect. And it's just K times V. So one way in nature that you can avoid this is if you have a surface tension, I believe. Do you want to get into that? I guess it's not really that necessary. But basically, you can have this in mind. If there is a surface tension, then that... So what the surface tension does, it wants to minimize the surface area. Because energy of surface tension is proportional to the area. So that's way. So that's why you wouldn't. That would resist the instability, because instability stretches the surface area, because it develops all kind of huge structures. But okay. So if you don't have surface tension, and if you don't have viscosity, I guess viscosity is also the other thing that always damps things. So the viscosity heats. It's like friction. You lose energy to viscosity. But if you don't have either of these two, viscosity or surface tension, this is what you can do. So now the next question is why you develop, or how you can develop turbulent structures. So what do you think? So what was your thought? So this is the first part of the problem, right? So the second part says instabilities like the one mentioned above make the fluid flow turbulent in any resistance situation. Explain quantitatively high complicated turbulent velocity field and arise with the repeated action of instability like the one describing.
Well, difference in the pressure and density is going to cause, you know, the turbulence. So.
So I guess the point is that you're going to make a fractal structure from this instability. Can you argue how you can make a fractal? Because here you have, these are linear perturbations, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's a way I can give you a hint, but don't give you the answer. But it's just that you have this, you generate this instability, but then at any point, you have a similar stability. So the same structure you produce on larger scale and a smaller scale, you produce the same thing.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
And so on. So
it's like internal inflation.
Mm-hmm.
It's like eternal inflation. So at any point you have this instability, So because there is no characteristic of the scale here, instability happens on every scale. Mm-hmm. So anything, any structure that you form, because this stability happens for every velocity, then within that structure you have an also instability. So you have for the same structure within that structure and so on. So same thing happens on all scales. Until you reach the scale where viscosity, for example, is important. There, this is cut off. But yes, so this is an example of a promenade that's a scale invariant. There is no characteristic scale here. So this frequency, the instability happens on all scales. Happens on different time scales, that's one thing to have in mind. It happens faster on small scales and slower on larger scales. But it's the same process on different time scales happening here. So that's, I guess that's really the answer. It's not necessarily a very deep answer. But
it asks quantitatively, like, how do you show that it's quantitative? You can say it's qualitative.
Yes. I don't know, they don't look very quantitative.
Exactly.
Yeah. Is that what it says? That's losing it. So it's 3 points. That's
it's on page 40.
Okay. Explain quantitatively. The explanation doesn't have any quantity. So yes, I mean I think okay. So maybe it's not a very accurate description. It's not very quantitative, but
it's not. No.
But that's perfect. I think yes, this is all we need, and it's just that you as long as you have an instability, you generate a scaling variant that doesn't have a characteristic of scaling it, and you generate a scaling variant in the structure as a result. Okay, good. So now, so the next part.
Oh, you can do that one.
You didn't do the next part? Okay, who did the next part? So the Kolmogorov growth cascade. That's part C. Nobody did it? You did it? All right. So why didn't the rest of you do part C?
We were working on it last night and it got too late.
I got too late.
Time factor and
yeah.
Well, I went through the description of the book that I didn't understand on the part C.
Okay, so we can discuss this and see how far we can go.
Maybe it's simple, but the description of the book is not clear. So.
It's not clear. Oh, let's see. Let's see if we can clarify it or not. So,
I didn't even understand really the question.
Okay. So why don't we then explain? Let me just read the question. Wait, it's a long question. So but there are two formulas that you're supposed to derive. That's it, basically. So there is one that tells you how velocity depends on a scale, and the other one is the power spectrum of the other is the power spectrum of velocity, which is essentially the same thing. Yes. So why don't you start? I mean, this is the object of the problem. The objective of the problem is just to see how velocity should depend on the scale in terms of flow.
Okay. I started this one out by calculating the rate at which energy flows from large scales to small scales. So representing energy flow by E dot, it's roughly proportional to, okay, first of all, the energy per unit mass of the particles. And I'll just say V lambda is velocity at this scale squared. So you kinetic energy is 1FM V squared. And then, so that's the energy at a given scale. And then multiply that by roughly the distance it's traveling, or the rate at which this energy moves down in scale, which is the velocity divided by the length scale. So putting this together, we can ignore the 1/2 since we're just working with a rough estimate. And
you know, actually that rate is comes from the last problem, that the part of Mina's call. If you just look at the formula that she has, just roll this. So this was about just k times v, right? So that was just k times v, right? It's just the first line there. And times some density, but that factor is of order one. And k is one over wavelength, and v is the relative velocity of this of different parts of the fluid. So the instability rate, so the rate at which you develop finer structure, finer structures, whatever structure you have on some scale, the instability rate at which you develop a smaller structure is just v divided by lambda, which is that form. So sorry for interruption. Sorry, go.
Now, for this case, we can assume that the rate of energy transfer has to be constant to some extent, at least once it reaches equilibrium, as otherwise, if the energy decreases as we go to, if energy transfer decreases as we go to smaller scales, energy will build up. It's just eventually, once it gets to the very small scales where viscosity happens, then it can be dissipated out by heat. But if it builds up at other scales, then we have the problem. So we can assume that this equals some constant, so then it's simply a matter of rearranging to get V lambda proportional to lambda to the 1/3, which, I believe is the first part of the problem. And then, then it's just a matter of rewriting this. So if we say that at some large length scale, if we have V of some large length scale, L equals U, then we can just put it back and get the equation. By just scaling the two sides to get U being the overall velocity at the largest scale.
Excuse me, did we assume that the energy change rate is constant?
Yeah.
Why did we assume this?
Because the energy really has no place to go. It'll either be constant, or at some level it's going to build up, or, it can't disappear. The only place it can go out is through heat, but within a fluid, heat is caused by viscosity. And for this part, we're working at scales above that at which viscosity matters. So if we have energy building up at some level, the result of that is the velocity of the fluid would increase there, because that's the only way it can store the energy, but that would cause it to be transferred inward faster. So eventually it'll reach some equilibrium of constant energy transfer.
So what you mean is that the whole energy should be constant, not the rate of change of it.
Well, the
this energy, it should be constant with length scale. Not rate of change in time, but just assume we're in some sort of equilibrium. The rate, this is the energy transfer, how energy moves through it, which is constant with the length scale we're looking at.
So the idea is that you have, and this is this, I guess this is a qualitative picture, so you cannot make this too accurate, but too precise. But the idea is that you have these eddies, it's basically vortices in the flow of different sizes. And you can imagine, just add up energy of all the vortices of a given size. And they are gaining energy, and they're also losing energy. They're gaining energy because there are bigger vortices that become unstable and make a smaller vortices. And they lose energy because these vortices become unstable because of the instability I discussed and make smaller vortices. So the rate at which they are gaining energy should be the same as the one that they lose energy. So it should be the same energy flow. Like in a sense, it's a continuity or conservation of energy. Because this should be the same rate of energy loss and gain, because you have the same energy. In a steady state, you have the same amount of energy statistically in all kinds of vortices. So energy starts from very big vortices and ends up at very small scales. But it's the same. It goes at the same rate, basically. It's like a pipeline, basically. It's the velocity should be the same through it, because otherwise it builds up somewhere. So that basically is the same. So instead of a amount of water, for example, we have energy. So that's the chromograph spectrum, basically. Okay, so then?
Okay, the next part of the problem asks us to estimate the length scale at which viscosity starts to matter. Mm-hmm. So the way to figure this out is figure out the rate of energy transfer from turbulence, or first of all, which we just take this value for V lambda, plug it back, and we get E dot U cubed over L. Lambda cancels out as we should expect, since it's constant with lambda. Then we have to find the scale at which the heat dissipation from viscosity is on the same order as this. Yeah. So a rough formula for the viscous energy loss at a length scale lambda is viscosity times cross-sectional area squared, and then we could estimate the cross-sectional area at some of lambda, or we're trying to put the square as being part. That sigma is the cross-section. What is that?
Gravity, I think.
Is the what?
It's velocity gradient.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Velocity gradient.
And you should be able to derive this from this. From the Euler equation, for example, right? Because, that's the Euler equation, right? So that gives you partial V by partial T.
Yeah.
And if you multiply that by V, then it gives you, or dot, take a dot product with V, that gives you partial V squared by partial T. And the right hand side becomes eta times V dot Laplacian of V. Mm-hmm. And if you want to average that, you can take one of the gradients, take it on the other side. So it becomes minus eta gradient of V squared. See what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Another way to do this is just the rough formula that you have, that gradient of V times area is the force across the surface. And if you have a force, you can get work done, basically, or dissipation rate, energy rate. It's just force times velocity, yeah, I believe. is as energy dissipation rate. And they're not, that should give you the same result. But this is basically energy dissipation per unit volume, I believe, right?
Yeah. And yeah, energy dissipation.
So is that a theory? It just comes from that formula.
So on this side, it's actually V dot rho here. And then just making some substitutions over there, we can find that's equal to eta to 2/3, lambda negative 4/3. And then, we can just solve for E dot in this case.
So this gives you the scale at which viscosity becomes important.
Yeah. So what we do is take this, set it equal to this, and solve for lambda to find that where viscosity is important. So something wrong here. Time scale times writing it this way, I just took the L out at the front first, and then in this format, you can identify that eta over rho UL is, in fact, 1 over the Reynolds number. So going scale is performed. Or the length scale at which viscosity matters is proportional to the length scale of the largest and used divided by the Reynolds number of the three quarters.
Mm-hmm.
Great.
Perfect. So what do you think? Does this make sense?
There's still room for printing question.
There is. I must have missed that.
Power spectrum was lost.
Yeah.
Mm. I must miss that reading over.
That's just another way of writing that formula. The first line that Brian has written there. So it's epsilon dot is V lambda cubed divided by lambda. And so the power spectrum of velocity is basically V lambda squared with some K factors. But you can see the why it's proportional to epsilon dot to the 1/3. But V lambda, is that right? So what is the definition of S of K that we have? So they've asked us to ask if you to derive S of K, which is, let's see, what is S of K? So S of K is basically V lambda squared times K inverse, for some reason. That's the definition. Okay, I'm
ready. So maybe K is lambda? Or
K is 1 over lambda.
Yeah, okay.
K is 1 over lambda, but I'm now a bit confused.
An estimate of the power at.
I think it should be epsilon. Length
scale lambda. Changing it to.
Ask for the power spectrum.
That's what it says.
That power spectrum mean the Fourier transform of the correlation.
That's what it says. Yes. S of k is the Fourier transform of the correlation function of velocity.
And we want to know how velocities in different scales are correlated. Is it right?
Yes. I mean, that's just V lambda, right? Because V lambda is the characteristic velocity of eddies of a given size. So that's roughly basically the correlation scale. The part I think it's kind of curious is should be epsilon dot to the 2/3. To the 2/3, not 1/3. Well, because V lambda squared is proportional to epsilon dot to the 2/3, right?
Yeah.
So maybe that's just a typo. Because otherwise,
well, what's the equation they have in there exactly?
So it says S of k is V lambda squared divided by k.
Okay, which is equal to V lambda squared lambda.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So does it get you? So if you substitute from that your first line,
so it would be e dot to the 2/3 lambda squared.
It's not lambda squared. It's lambda minus 2 to the power of minus 2/3. Plus 2/3 plus 1.
Well, k is 1 over lambda, right?
That's fine, yes.
Okay, so the first line, right, then V lambda squared lambda, okay. Right, yeah, so 2/3.
Plus 1.
Plus 1, so 5/3?
Yes. 5/3.
That should be 2/3.
Yeah, so that should be 2/3. Does anybody have a more recent copy of this book? I have an older copy. Maybe they have corrected it. Do you have?
I don't have it on.
This is
an old one, I guess.
You think it's an old one? Well, but is it 2/3 or 1/3?
It's 1/3.
Okay. So, somebody had a copy of this. I saw it somewhere. Did you have a copy of this?
Yeah, I could look, but I don't think it's. I'm pretty sure it's old.
Okay. Anyway, so. Okay, so that's a typewriter.
Should say it's a typewriter. Okay.
But that's it's just another way of writing. Somehow the people who do fluid mechanics like this S of K more than V lambda. I don't know why. So that's all there is to it. And that's also an interesting expression that, as you would expect, Reynolds number, the larger it is, the smaller is the scale at which the viscosity becomes important. So all the scales larger than that and could be very, and as we saw in the last problem, the Reynolds number could be very large. So there could be a large factor between the size of the problem and the scale which is becoming important. And you have this huge dynamical range from the size of the box to this viscous scale, where you have this a scale-free turbulence, so it's called the Kolmogorov cascade. And more or less in this whole range, you have that rough formula that tells you how the velocity should scale with the size of your eddy. So it basically goes as wavelength to the power of 1/3. So it's a very convenient formula, and it's rough, and it's some situations it can break down, but it seems to work in most of the places. That's really almost all you need to know about turbulence. Anything more than that, it's much more controversial, much less clear. So perfect. Thank you.
So you have no more questions about this, by the way?
No. Okay, so that's almost does it for, let's see, so problem three, it's, I don't think we can do justice to it. Let's see, it's 3 points.
Can we talk about question five?
You want to talk about question five? Absolutely. Yeah, problem three, I think it's going to take a while maybe for us to see. So, sure. What do you want to know? What do you want to talk about?
How we do it?
So we're trying to find a relation between turbulence and molecular viscosity.
No.
So we know that viscosity is going to give an angular contraction.
So molecular viscosity is small. Right, so somebody should put this on like this. Okay. So because R is large, that means, and in all astrophysical situations that you check, R is very large. But molecular viscosity is small, so it's almost irrelevant for most of the processes, most of the situation in astrophysics. So, but instead you have this turbulence. Now, I guess the angular momentum transport is something we have to discuss in some of the previous problems. I'm guessing problem three or four, we did discuss angular momentum transport. But that's basically one thing that's necessary for accretion, because if you have gas going around a star, for example, as long as there is no viscosity, basically these annuli don't see each other, there is no friction, so they just go around and around and around and nothing happens. So you need viscosity for accretion to happen, for stuff to actually be able to eventually lose energy and fall into the central star. But molecular viscosity is very small, so the idea is that you have an effective turbulent viscosity, and that would do it for you. So the idea of problem five is that basically go through a similar calculation that we did for problem one. Well, it's not going to be an exact calculation, but a rough calculation. But here, instead of molecules scattering off each other, you have these eddies. That's basically how you have a whole hierarchy of eddies with this formula, with this kind of property. And it's not really an exact calculation. What I want you to do to calculate an effective eta, which is a transport of angular, well, momentum, angular momentum, it doesn't matter either. Instead of molecules, the previous picture that we have, I guess we erased it. Instead of the previous picture, we had that looks like this, and then there were these molecules, the random velocities. Now you have a bunch of eddies. Instead of molecules, you have a bunch of eddies of all possible sizes. And with the same definition of eta, the same definition of viscosity, can you actually write down an effective viscosity in a situation like this? That you have this turbulent flow, but then there is this the overall gradient of velocity, and how fast basically momentum from these eddies is transferred to these eddies. That's basically the kind of factor. And this is, again, is going to be a rough calculation.
Would you define like an effective cross section of the eddies or something?
You can do that, and I mean this. So there is no fine trick here. It's just the effective cross section could be the effective size of the eddy is the relevant value. So you can use that to define a cross section. But you don't. It's not an exact analogy. So these aren't like molecules, because molecules are point-like objects and their interactions are local. These eddies aren't point-like objects, they're big objects, and they don't really move very much before hitting another eddy. So it's you cannot make an exact analogy between the two. But you can still come up with a rough formula, and I think it might even be a dimensional analysis, so you might be able to even do it just within dimensional analysis, because there are actually fewer parameters here. So all you have is basically the total size of the system, whatever it is, the thickness of the disk,
and the characteristic velocity. And that's that basically fixes everything, right? That fixes the whole, more or less, the whole cascade. It's U and L. And then there's also, of course, the density, the mean density of the medium. So there are the three parameters. So you might actually be just doing, just based on dimensional analysis, or you can use some rough physical argument, like the one that I gave you for molecules. But that's the idea. And this is basically how people do accuracy this until this day, because any more accurate model is just not possible. I mean, you could do simulations, but they are not really that accurate, because you cannot exactly capture the whole physics. So this is basically what's occurring in the Earth some 30 years ago, and that is still the model that everybody uses. So it's better off. It's more really just dimensional analysis. Okay, so that does it for this session. Hope you enjoyed it. And we're going to finish this problem set next week. And you're going to give me the solutions next week, right? So nobody has actually finished the solutions this week. No? No. Okay. But next week, you're all going to finish it, right? Perfect.